From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, deja vu and emotions. Hope you had a great weekend, and let's get your week underway. Here's what's happening. The scores of American and District of Columbia flags sailing above Pennsylvania Avenue are a traditional sign of a coming presidential inauguration. And this year, though, there are some new indicators. Thousands of armed troops and police officers blocking off streets and miles of barricade fencing. The bustle of the nation's capital before an inauguration has now been replaced with the very eerie quiet of a city in lockdown. The deadly January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol has turned pre-inaugural Washington into a secured encampment, one that has drawn comparisons with Baghdad's Green Zone, where foreign embassies are located. The newly fortified nation's capital, also beset by the continuing coronavirus pandemic, saw little activity over the weekend ahead of the transfer of power to President-elect Joe Biden, which will take place on Wednesday. We will have complete coverage for you Wednesday night on the happenings of that event. The FBI is investigating evidence that a woman who entered the Capitol on January 6th stole a laptop or hard drive from Speaker Nancy Pelosi's office and intended to sell it to the Russians. This bizarre claim, which the FBI emphasized remains under investigation, was included in an affidavit describing the criminal case against Riley June Williams, a Pennsylvania woman who was seen in the footage on the January 6th insurrection in the area of the Capitol near Pelosi's office. It's not clear if the FBI has been able to apprehend her at this time. Thought we'd bring in our expert on the Internet, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, first of all, why this interest in laptops? What the, people store everything on these things?
Well, you know, I've been watching this story, and it's kind of interesting in this regard. Here's where it seems to stand right now. I mean, we first have to start that a lot of the details aren't confirmed. So there apparently was a confirmation from Pelosi's chief of staff that a laptop had been stolen. But if that's the laptop that we're talking about, it apparently was only used for routine presentations. It would not likely have contained anything of interest to Russia. The reports are that the information about wanting to sell a Pelosi laptop to Russia came from a past romantic partner of the suspect. And since the suspect is reportedly still at large, as you noted, after reports say she seems to have nuked her phone number and social media accounts, authorities haven't been able to ask her about this, not yet. Now, if we assume for the sake of the argument that the story is true, it looks like the laptop was simply a target of opportunity. On the assumption that there would have been some sort of valuable secrets or something worth selling to Russia in there. But that was never going to be likely, among other reasons, because Congress doesn't leave stuff like that around in easily accessible laptops. And in fact, there are special secure rooms called SCIFs where such documents are kept in Congress, and I've heard nothing to suggest that those secure rooms were penetrated during the attack on the Capitol at all. Now, obviously, it's going to take quite a long time to fully understand these events, but given the enormous amount of phone-based metadata, cell site pings, GPS data, and the like, and of course, the vast numbers of videos that persons who entered the Capitol streamed and posted themselves that now have become public, the situation might easily set a record for having the most electronic evidence for authorities to use. And this is obviously going to be a continuing saga.
All right, my friend. Thanks. Keep your eyes out on it for us, Lauren. Dr. Erica Pan is a California epidemiologist, has issued a statement recommending a pause in the distribution of a specific lot of Moderna vaccine after fewer than 10 individuals required medical attention over the span of 24 hours. She's concerned about that. Germany's worst COVID breakers will be held in detention centers under new proposals being drawn up by a number of state governments. The move forms part of the country's efforts to stop the spread of the more contagious mutant strain of the virus detected in the United Kingdom. So Germany is going to hold COVID rule breakers in refugee camps under new crackdowns. Phil Spector, the music producer responsible for some of the biggest hits in music and the architect of the Wall of Sound, has died. People are told that he died from COVID-related complications after being transferred from his prison cell to a hospital. He apparently was diagnosed 4 weeks ago, went in the hospital, but recovered well enough to return to prison, where he was serving a 19-to-life sentence for the murder of Alana Clarkson. With an eye toward reuniting the country after the turbulent presidency of Donald Trump, President-elect Joe Biden marked the Martin Luther King Jr. federal holiday by volunteering. The president-elect and his wife, the incoming First Lady Jill, made a short trip from their home in Wilmington, Delaware, to Philadelphia to volunteer at Abundance, it's called, a hunger relief organization, during the official day of service to celebrate the historic civil rights leader's life and legacy. Martin Luther King Jr. made this speech in Washington, D.C. in 1963.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
5 years later, he was dead by an assassin's bullet. The Mega Millions lottery is still looking for a winner to claim the second largest grand prize in the game's history. The pot has grown, with the jackpot reaching more than an estimated $850 million after no winner was declared during Friday's drawing. The lottery winners can either opt for a cash option, a one-time lump sum payment, or an annuity paid out over the course of about 30 years. Take it up front. The cash option estimated at $628 million. There will be a drawing Tuesday, and I'm told another one on Wednesday as well. Look up in the sky. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Nope, it's Dr. Sky looking at the sky. Hi, Stephen. What do you got for us?
Hello, George. Jam-packed information as always. We begin with space. Virgin Galactic, George and Richard Branson have made some space history with his unconventional satellite launch system. He launched 10 of these small CubeSat-type satellites from, get a load of this, a 70-foot rocket attached to their airborne 747, tail code N744VG, that launch platform known as Cosmic Girl. And the successful test placed these small satellites, George, in orbit from a location off the Pacific Ocean. This is a new and very cost-effective way to get satellites into low Earth orbit. Some uses of the CubeSats are for tracking shipping containers at sea. How about this? Tracking cattle and even tracking a plastic bottle as it would be moving along an ocean current, as we, of course, want to map thermal currents in the ocean. The successful launch systems opens up a growing market naturally for satellite services of the future. But the launch rocket, George, is known as the Launcher 1. It's a two-stage, 70-foot-long rocket powered by these Newton rocket engines, using RP-1 and liquid oxygen as a propellant. George, can you imagine sitting on that side of the 747 and watching on the left side this massive rocket coming
up? I know. Amazing.
And imagine them pulling that airplane up into the sky. That would be one hell of a ride. But we move on to astronomy, George. Globular clusters in the sky are some of the oldest star systems known. They encircle our Milky Way galaxy, and we know of at least 150 of these globular clusters in the Milky Way. But where did most of them come from? Astronomers, George, are telling us now through research that the galaxy, the Milky Way, merged with a smaller dwarf galaxy with a strange name. It's known as the Gaia Sausage some 11 billion years ago. The galaxy collided and, of course, looked like a sausage. It may have added at least 8 of these globular clusters. But more importantly, this particular collision, and this happens a lot in galaxy systems, this one may have added some 50 billion star masses to our Milky Way. So looking at galactic collisions may be the source of star creations on a larger scale. We wrap it up, George, with the live sky, things that we all can see. In the first quarter moon on the 20th, it's the best time of the month to see the dark shadows on the craters on the moon in a north and south line. That line is called, on the sunrise line, the Terminator. Best in binoculars, even better in telescopes. Sad to see, George, Jupiter and Saturn fade into solar conjunction, but they put on a hell of a show throughout this past year. And a great time, finally, to observe the constellation Orion. This is a must-see constellation in the southeast at 8 p.m. local time. And from the star George Betelgeuse to Rigel, the stars of Orion are bright enough to the naked eye to see some interesting things. But look to the lower left of the belt stars of Orion for the amazing Orion Nebula, some 1,344 light-years away, another location where stars are born. Love the emails, Dr. Sky Show, that is, at gmail.com. More information always at theskylive.com. Simply, always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. Proud to be your navigator on the highway to the heavens. Thank you so much, George.
Thank you, Dr. Sky. We'll talk to you next week. The Arecibo Telescope in Puerto Rico has been an incredible instrument for scientists and astronomers, and it's collapsed. But will it ever come back? In a moment, we're going live to Puerto Rico to talk about that telescope on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me introduce our guest for the next couple hours. Angel Vasquez was born in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, and grew up in Brooklyn, New York. From the age there where he attended the University of CUNY, Brooklyn campus, and he worked as a radio engineer for a year before moving back to Puerto Rico and taking a job at the Arecibo Observatory back in 1977 to right now. He has received various ham radio awards as well and is currently the head of the telescope operations at Arecibo. Angel, thank you for joining us. I know it's very early in the morning out there. Well, it's about 2 o'clock or so in the morning out there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, thank you very much there, George, and welcome. Thank you for having me on. Yeah, it's about 2 o'clock in the morning here, but it's great to be here. And salutations to all the coast listeners.
Thank you, Angel. Tell us about the telescope. What's its situation right now? We keep hearing that it's fallen apart, it's collapsed. Then we hear that there may be some money to put in to help restore it. Where do we stand with the telescope?
Well, right now, George, as we know, on December 1st, there was a collapse after a couple of cables failed on the tower. And the situation is now we're looking forward to a rebuild. Okay, this rebuild, though, it's going to take quite a bit of money here, George. It'll be about three. We're estimating about maybe $350 million, maybe $400 million to reestablish a telescope the way we had it. The thing is that the owners of the Arecibo telescope is the National Science Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
The National Science Foundation doesn't have that kind of money, so this would have to come from external sources, something like maybe a congressional appropriation or maybe. Somebody with some extra change in their pocket, if you will, and so we're looking for these different angles, and again we've got to make we're trying to let everyone know the importance why we wanted to put it there in Arecibo. Arecibo already established itself in the radio astronomy world. It's uniqueness. So we're trying to pull that on that lever there, George.
Across the world, Angel, how many huge radio telescopes are out there and active?
Well, right now, see, that's a good question because there are many telescopes, radio, and we're talking about radio telescopes again. The Arecibo Observatory was a radio telescope.
Mm-hmm.
It was unique in its sense that it was a radio radar telescope. Everyone knows that the Chinese, the FAST telescope in China, has a larger collective area, about 500 meters. Odyssey was 305 meters. So that one is very large. We have the very large array in New Mexico. But the uniqueness of the observatory, the Odyssey Observatory, was that it had a radar. Okay, it was always, until its collapse, the largest radio radar telescope on Earth. And so although China has a large collecting area, it doesn't have any radar. So it was very unique in its sense. But there are a couple of other many other radio telescopes in the world, George.
When did that telescope at Arecibo, Angel, go online? Back in the 70s or even before that?
No, even before that, George. We had the construction started in 1959, believe it or not.
Wow.
1959. Yeah, 1959. It took about 3 years for three or four years. So we actually started its first observation. It was inaugurated on November 1st, 1963. And it's gone through, and it went through various upgrades. The original, for example, the original surface. Again, the surface of the radio telescope, the dish itself, was 1,000 feet. It used to be it was composed of 1,000 foot diameter half inch chicken mesh. Okay, that's a lot of chicken mesh. That's like 20 acres of this. But then we went through an upgrade. We noticed that if we change the surface of the dish, we can go higher in frequencies and also install a transmitters and go and have a much broader range in radio sciences. And so in 1974, we went through the first upgrade phase, and we changed the surface from that chicken mesh to perforated aluminum panels. If you looked at the picture, it actually looks like a smooth surface. Well, that smooth surface made it possible for us to go higher in frequency, and obviously it changed the radio uniqueness of the observatory starting in 1974, actually.
I'll always remember the 1995 movie, GoldenEye, the James Bond flick, Angel, that illustrated Arecibo, and I just couldn't believe how massive that structure was.
Yes, it is. That's right. We during the second upgrade, we're putting the Gregorian dome system on the platform, and so we were kind of a shutdown. So Hollywood came to visit us a couple of times. We did that movie GoldenEye, and I had the privilege of giving Pierce Brosnan the tour himself. And it is a massive structure. That structure above the dish, it's about 500 feet above the dish. And at the time of the collapse, it weighed 900 tons. People that look at that, 900 tons. And people that looked at that, at that arm, there was a curved arm underneath the triangle. That curved arm from tip to tip, George, was larger than a football field. That's 302 feet long.
Angel, tell us a little bit about a radio telescope. I mean, we're all familiar with the optical telescopes where you look in the telescope lens and see the great pyramid, the planets and stars and things like that. But with a radio telescope, it's different. But how does that work?
Yeah, so the radio telescope, that's a great question itself. So, yeah, people think when you say telescope, people always think of, you know, it's still, oh, where is the eyepiece on this thing? It is a radio telescope. So the Arecibo Observatory, how it worked is you had that large reflective area, that 1,000-foot dish. So the signals would come from space. They would bounce off the dish and be picked up by one of the antennas suspended 500 feet above. Again, this is not a parabola, you know, a parabolic dish. A parabolic dish, all signals bounce into one point.
Mm-hmm.
This was a spherical dish where it reflects in one line. In this sense, that this was it gave us the capability of tracking a source across the sky for about 2.5 hours. So we picked up the signal. And the signals are picked up by the receivers on the platform and sent down to the control room. And for example, in we have three phases of there are three radio sciences that were done at Arecibo. One being radio astronomy, which is passive, which we listen to, you know, pulsars, quasars, galaxies, you know, the new FRBs. And then we had atmospheric sciences where we study ion densities in the ionosphere using a transmitter, a 2.5 megawatt transmitter. And then we had planetary radar where we bounce signals over the nearby planets, comets, and asteroids. So when these signals come into the control room, they'll get digitized, and we can make a picture just as though you were looking at it through an eyepiece. So the radio telescopes can go much further than we can see to the edge of the universe where we cannot see with light. There is a certain distance that we can see with these telescopes. With the radio telescope, we can detect signals that are very, 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 very far away. So we don't depend on the light coming into a lens. We can listen to things that are millions and millions of light years away there, George.
That's exciting. And I would guess if you can raise the $350 million, you've got a state-of-the-art radio telescope again, don't you?
Well, that's what we want, exactly. And again, the three radio sciences, they're all pulling for each on their own side. So we have scientists from all over the world. We're having, you know, continuous meetings and stuff. And you have the radio, radio astronomers wanting, how we can do for radio science. for that, for radio astronomy and the planetary radar scientists pulling there, and the atmospheric scientists pulling on their side. And but everyone is all on board on trying to get this again to Arecibo again, because we have proved that the system worked. And again, it was unique and no one.
Well, we want to get it fixed. Hold on, Angel. We're going to hit a commercial break, but we'll come right back and talk more about Arecibo. And then we'll take calls with you next hour. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Angel Vasquez with us as we're talking about the Arecibo telescope. Angel, how did you get involved with the telescope?
Well, that was way back there. In 19, I was a radio engineer for the city of New York, for WNYC in New York.
Yeah.
And I had to move family health reasons. So we had to move to Puerto Rico, and because... my ex-wife had an asthma condition, so we moved here in Puerto Rico. So when I got to Puerto Rico, there was an opening at the Arecibo Observatory, and I applied and I got the job, and it was the best decision that I have made in my life, one of them. And so I got involved. That was back on August 25th, 1977, George, and that's how. Since then, I was. Again, we were looking for other things at the observatory. It wasn't. I always liked radio astronomy and being at Arecibo. That was kind of an interesting thing there. But I wasn't actually looking to work at the radio telescope. But engineering positions weren't available. Radio engineering positions weren't available in broadcast and stuff like that locally. So this popped up. And I said, okay, we could try this. And again, it's been a wonderful place to work for me for over 43 years. So I've had a great run with that, George. And that's how. So as I originally got involved with it, my original position there was like in operations, the telescope operations. And then we had a few positions during these 43 years.
Well, let's hope they get it up and running. And once the cable started snapping, did you folks know there's something wrong here?
Well, yeah. So the first cable that snapped, okay, that was August 10th. So that was an auxiliary cable, George. This wasn't a main cable. The difference is the main cables are the ones from the tower to the triangle itself. When we did an upgrade and when we added that Gregorian dome system, that dome back in 95, right, during that movie period that we spoke about earlier, that was an auxiliary cable that came loose from the socket. Okay, that cable was put there to prevent the torque from the platform. So that was in August 10th. And so that was a big problem. So we decided we had to move this cable. Again, this cable that came out of the socket. It didn't break. It came loose from the socket during that upgrade. And that cable is about 20,000 pounds.
Wow.
And so we were, yeah, I said 20,000 pounds. This is a 3-inch bridge strand. And it was like 600 feet long. And so we're talking, a little piece of this cable, a foot of this cable weighs about 35 pounds. We're talking about 20,000 pounds. So, and the thing is, when it fell and it broke a couple of the panels on the dish, we're going to see, how do we get this cable out? And so we were thinking how to do this. Again, we have a 10,000-pound winch on the platform, but again, we're talking 20,000 pounds. And so... So we knew we were kind of in trouble there. So when this cable, this auxiliary cable came loose, excuse me, that put stress on the other cable that on that tower. And so that was August 10th. And then on November 6th, now we have a cable snapping from the tower. Okay, that now this is a main cable. This is one of the main cable that holds the tower, that on November 6th, that one kind of broke off. And so this one didn't come out of a socket. This one actually, the strands start to snap, That one came apart. Now we're in dire need of trying to stabilize this platform, because but again, it was so dangerous. There was just no way to stabilize this without endangering a human life. And so we're trying to think about the different ways to release weight from the platform with helicopters and the like. But the situation was just so dangerous that the National Science Foundation said, listen, we're just going to have to we're going to decommission this for the safety of all the personnel. And so they didn't want to decommission the site, the radio observatory itself, because we do have a smaller dish, and we still have some photometers that measure air glow and LIDARs and the like. They didn't want to close the observatory site itself, but that cable snapping, then we said, well, this is going to come down. We wanted to do a safer trying to lower the platform, but there was just no way. Because
right.
of these two cables snapping, it was just no way. We knew these other cables. We can see. Then we started to see strands popping from the other cables. Okay, so these every time one of these cables came off, it released about 40,000 pounds of
pressure.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
Did you expect it to go that quickly once the second cable went?
No, since the second cable went, we knew it was going to go. We kind of knew because we saw there was no way to stop it. There was a snowball effect. This was this, and it's going, a snowball going downhill, and we knew it was going to go, but we didn't know it was going to take less than a month. And on December 1st of last year, in the early morning period, then the telescope, which was a disastrous sight. We knew, George, we knew this was going to happen, but, knowing this would happen and then seeing it happen are two different things. It was just it was just like losing a friend.
I was going to say, it must have been emotional for you, Angel.
Oh, it is. I've given quite a few interviews itself, and the first time, and on Zoom platforms, and the first time I've seen the video, obviously we've seen the video. But the first time me talking about this, George, I didn't think I was very emotional. This was very difficult for me to see. This is my friend for 43 years.
Oh,
this is my life really. So it was very difficult to see. Definitely, George.
I remember, Angel, back in 1996 when I was doing a local show in St. Louis, Missouri. I was interviewing Seth Shostak from SETI, who was in Puerto Rico at the telescope, and he was live with me talking about it and what it was like. And for years, you had a great relationship with the SETI, the folks who are looking for extraterrestrial intelligence out there.
Oh, yeah. Well, Seth is a really good friend. Seth Shostak is a very, very good friend of mine, and also a fellow radio amateur. And obviously... Dr. Jill Tarter. And you mentioned about movies at the observatory. Well, the other famous movie at the observatory, George, was Contact.
That's
We've
right.
Had some other ones. We've
great.
Had some other ones. But Contact, well, Jill Tarter, the role that
Jodie Foster played.
Jodie Foster played was in life with Jill Tarter. So this is a book, Contact by Carl Sagan. But this is Jill Tarter was the real life. Ellie Arroway, and so she was also working there with Seth Shostak and the SETI project. And again, SETI at the beginning was funded by the government, and so
that's right.
Nothing was found. Well, the government kind of just stopped, funding this project, but never went away. The interest never went away. One of our directors, the past directors. It was the one that started the whole thing, Frank Drake. And so he was involved with Seth and Jill Tarter. And what they did, although they stopped funding it by the government, well, it was privately funded. And we came back with this called Project Phoenix. we're rising from the ashes again and the like. And so SETI never went away. And having a big radio telescope and our largest, and at the time, the largest collective area on Earth, it was just if we were going to look for a signal, we were going to use Arecibo. Because we could find signals that we could detect signals that no other telescope on Earth could have detected. So it was a very, very a big part of it back then. So, yes. The thing is, we're looking for Perseti here, George, looking for an extraterrestrial signal. It's not an easy thing. Remember, we're looking at a signal the way we're looking at it. We're looking at it with radio signals, okay? Radio signals travel at the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second. So, like, for example, our closest neighbor, right? Our closest neighbor is in the Alpha, Alpha Centauri, in the Alpha Centauri. And that's about four miles away. Proxima Centauri also. That's about four light years away. So what that means is that if you travel at 186,000 miles a second for four years, you'll get to our closest neighbor. That is our closest neighbor. And our second neighbor after that is 10 light years away. So if you travel at that speed, the speed of light for 10 years, we'll get to our second neighbor. So in our galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, which you were talking about a little while ago, our Milky Way galaxy has billions and billions and billions of stars. Okay, that's when I said about neighbors, that's in our neighboring a star. Our sun is a star. And so in our galaxy, we have billions and billions and billions of stars with that many possibilities. But then again, on top of that, George, we have billions and billions of galaxies. So one of the analogies I say, imagine taking a bucket of sand and trying to count every grain of sand in there. Well, that's just minute. I mean, if you take your favorite beach and trying to count all the grains of sand on your favorite beach, George, in the universe, there are more suns, stars, than there are grains of sand on Earth.
That's amazing.
I'm talking about your beach, Mojave Desert. I mean, I'm talking about all the deserts, everything on Earth. There are more grains of sand than there are more planets, stars, than grains of sand. So there are possibilities. So there are scientists that there has to be another possibility. The thing is, again, we're trying to detect it with the radio signal. And where are we going to look? Where are they in their evolution? Remember, if someone looked at the Earth 200 years ago, they say, well, they were on another star, and they were trying to look at. They had a big telescope looking at Earth. They would say, well, there's no intelligent life there. Oh yes, there was intelligent life. We had all these prophets and the likes of Da Vinci's, and there were a lot of geniuses in the world. You know what we didn't have, George, was a radio transmitter. Okay,
exactly.
So that didn't come up for in the last 100 years. So we could be looking at stars that are not in that part of the evolution in their evolution. And so it's a very, very, very difficult thing to try to detect, again, because of the distance and the proximity of where they are in their evolution. So again, we try to listen to all these thousands and thousands of frequencies at the same time when we're looking. And everyone says, so how do you know it's going to be an ET signal? Well, I'll just give you an example. So if we're looking for in the sky, and every object in the universe emits radio frequencies. Okay, even your body emits radio waves. And so if we're looking at a star, and you can listen to it, and so let's say there's a star, for an example. If we're looking at the star and the sky is going over, And just a regular star goes over, and this is just an exaggerated form, but this is the way it would be. You would hear like a hiss, like hiss, and then a shh, and a hiss, and then okay, that's down. Now that's a regular star. Now if it was an intelligent a star, you would hear the hiss. It would go hiss, hiss. Now when you hear a beep, that means that's a very, very narrow band signal, which only an intelligent civilization can create.
Have we found any of those?
And so no such signals have been found, confirmed, yet. Okay, so we had, there was back in 77, there was that signal back in Ohio State University that found something like that. And there have been... a candidate, but remember, for a scientist to confirm any real discovery, we have to go back and detect it again.
Yeah.
And so, if you go back and detect it again, and we can't, well, then it can't be confirmed, Judge.
Exactly. How would you compare the Hubble Space Telescope to the Arecibo Radio Telescope, Angel?
Well, the Hubble was a great invention. After the first, they had a huge problem at the beginning. But the Hubble telescope is great because, when you're using an optical telescope from Earth, the atmosphere and the atmosphere will diffuses some of the signal. So the Hubble telescope went out into space and did this. But then again, the Hubble telescope is relying on the on optical wavelengths. And optical wavelengths, again, we're depending on this light coming into the telescope, whereas a radio telescope, we can penetrate, through the atmosphere or anything else. This is why I can talk to you from inside my home office here to you in California, because radio waves penetrate everything, okay? And so we don't depend on light reaching our eye. We can actually go to this to the furthest depths of space with a radio telescope, George.
That's amazing work. We're going to take a break pretty soon, but let me ask you, what has been the most unusual thing the telescope has spotted? I've seen a picture, for example, of the spider stars that Arecibo found, which are these eight-pronged stars. They look amazing, but what would you say is the most amazing thing?
Well, I'm kind of biased on a couple of these things here, but there were a few things. And let me just real quick here. The observatory actually, we established that the rotating rate of Mercury was not what it was. It turned out to be 59 days rather than what everyone estimated was 88 days. Okay, but then during the first upgrade. Then, Dr. Joe Taylor and Ross Holtz discovered a binary pulsar system. Okay, now that was incredible. We also found the first planets outside our solar system also was discovered back in the early 1990s, Alex Voshek. And so the first planets outside, so that was an amazing discovery. To discover planets outside our own solar system, that was amazing. But that was because of the first discovery of pulsars, and that discovery earned Joe Taylor Russ Holt the Nobel Prize back in 1993. And I was very fortunate to work with Joe Taylor on this project. And that for me, these neutron stars, pulsars are neutron stars. So you can imagine the size of our sun, a star the size of our sun, and then collapsing it into a 10-kilometer ball, okay, without losing the mass, without losing a mass, okay? So that's like taking the Earth and compressing it to the size of a basketball without losing any of the mass. A teaspoon of this thing would weigh, 10 billion tons. A teaspoon, and these things, they rotate, and every time this pulsar rotates, it emits a radio signal. And these things, some of these things spin about 500 times a second, So these things for me are just mind-boggling.
Space is amazing, Angel. We're going to take a break at the top of the hour. We'll come back and talk about more of your work at Arecibo. And also we'll take calls next on Coast to Coast AM.